let your spirit once again. Jesus, I just want to hear you calling out my name, saying, well done, good and faithful one, well done today.
When Naomi decides to go home to Bethlehem, one of the girls leaves, and Naomi is left with Ruth. And it's Ruth that taught us last week this meaning of what commitment is all about. Not just commitment to a friend, but even, gosh, I've been blown away with how many times this verse has shown up in either the worship or, of course, I did the wedding last Saturday, so I threw it in because it was like, wow, this was like the coolest thing that I figured out last week that was just really neat. And Ruth says this. Ruth said, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything, but death parts you from me. What a great statement of commitment. Amen? Isn't that the coolest thing? This is what commitment is all about. This is what real commitment is all about. When Naomi and Ruth arrive in Bethlehem, Ruth goes to work. She takes a job to support her and her mother-in-law. She takes the job of gleaning in the fields. Gleaning was a practice back then that they did instead of welfare. They would put you to work. And what gleaning was picking up the leftovers in the fields, whatever the reapers didn't get. and just by coincidence, Ruth ends up in the field of Boaz. I had to continue the theme of the stick figures. I thought that would be good. So there's Boaz. She ends up in the field of Boaz, a wealthy man who happens to be a close relative to Naomi. Boaz treats Ruth with kindness and suggests that maybe she should stay in his field and work in his field while she's gleaning. We pick it up in chapter 3, verse 1. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? I want to seek security, she says, for you, that it may be well with you. And I got to say this. I don't want to miss this. She's talking about getting the girl married. And what she's saying, this idea of security, peace, the word for being well is a word that speaks of pleasantness, goodness. And I got to tell you this, gang. The Bible's concept of marriage is that marriage is good. Now, I know some of you aren't quite so sure about that. I know that some of you have been through terribly difficult times. And I know some of you have experience that tells you marriage not good. When I hear about marriage, I want to run because it's a mess. But I got to tell you, God's idea of marriage is that it's good. Promise, sometimes marriage doesn't end up being what we think it's going to be, and we end up wanting something else. A couple was married for 25 years, and they were also at the same time as their anniversary, were celebrating their 60th birthdays. During the celebration, a fairy appears and says that she's going to give this loving couple, because they're such a loving couple all these years, she's going to give each one of them a wish. So the wife says she's always wanted to travel around the world. The fairy waves her magic wand, and boom, there's the tickets. She's got tickets in her hand, and when it's her husband's turn, he pauses for a moment, then he says slyly, well, I'd like to have a woman 30 years younger than me. The fairy waves her wand. Boom, and he's 90 years old. So be careful what you wish for. I think sometimes we get ourselves into trouble when we begin to think that the good is what's outside of our marriage instead of what we have. God's idea of marriage from the beginning has been good. Genesis 2:18. the marriage foundation says, and the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him. God's idea was that aloneness is not good, and God's resolution was to create marriage. So it's not that some of you are called to be single. That's good. Nothing, no problem with that. There's not a problem. But you got to be careful when we start getting cynical because of all the problems that there are in the world with marriage. We live in an incredibly horrible time to be married, don't we? We live in a day and an age when marriage is a joke for some people. It's not that in God's eyes. Marriage is good. God is the one who invented it, and he says it's good. My point is not to give you a magic fix for the difficulties of marriage, but I just want to remind you that it is good. Verse 2, Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. This is Naomi speaking to Ruth. He is winnowing at the threshing floor. Boy, it's, for some reason I'm having a hard time with the clicker tonight. Now remember that Naomi and Ruth showed up during the harvest time, during the barley harvest. Winnowing and threshing are parts of how you process the wheat, making it usable for food. Here's a clip that gives us some instruction about this.
Threshing is the act of separating the grains from the stalks and, more importantly, freeing the kernels from the husks. These are also called the hulls or chaff. Early threshing methods basically amounted to beating grain heads with some sort of club or hand flail. Or a threshing board could be dragged around in circles by a mule or an ox. A simpler technique for classroom settings is to lay the grain heads on a rubber mat and stomp on them. The shoes or boots used should have a flexible rubber sole so that the grains don't get damaged. We can experiment with different shoes to find the best sole for the job. The right amount of pressure should push the grain out of the holes without damaging the seed coat. When most of the kernels have been pressed out of their husks, it is time to separate out the grain. The kernels and chaff need to be placed in a pan or a bucket.
Now this is important. Watch this.
Set up an electric fan in front of a tarp and set another pan or bowl in front of the fan to catch the falling kernels. If we slowly pour the wheat across the airstream, we should end up with nearly clean seeds landing in front of the fan.
Now, the only thing I can't figure out is how Boaz and Ruth and Naomi, where they got the electric fan. That's the only thing I can't figure out. Ancient farmers didn't have electric fans, so they did the winnowing out in an open field. And they would do the same things this guy is teaching people in backwards countries how to thresh and winnow the wheat. You got to crush it somehow. You got to throw it up in the air, and the wind carries the stuff away. And so he is winnowing barley out on the threshing floor. Verse 3, therefore, this is what Naomi tells Ruth, therefore wash yourself and anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. She says, go wash and anoint. Now, you know, in those days, they didn't take showers every day. I just, you know, that kind of wasn't, that was a not very often kind of a thing. So she's telling her, you know, you better wash up a little bit, girl, put a little perfume on, you know, put the makeup on. That's the Hebrew word for anointing is makeup us. I'm making this up too. And she says, make yourself known to the man. Don't do it until he's finished eating and drinking, you know, because us guys, we're kind of cranky when we haven't had our dinner. And so she, you know, Naomi knows this stuff. So she says, just make sure that the guy's eating. He's a happy camper before you do anything. Verse 4, then it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in and cover his feet and lie down. And he will tell you what you should do. Now, some of you might be single, and you're looking at this thinking, is this what I'm supposed to do? No. This doesn't work today, okay? This is what worked 3,000 years ago. This is not what works today. So when he lies down, you watch where he's lying down. Go in, uncover his feet and lie down. Now, the idea of uncovering his feet is simply the idea of making it so the guy will wake up in the middle of the night. That's it. Don't draw any more conclusions than that. The idea is just to, so that in the middle of the night, his toesies are going to get cold, and he's going to think, what's going on? He's going to fuss, and then he's going to wake up. Okay? And Ruth is to let Boaz decide what happens next. She's not supposed to do anything more. She's just supposed to put it in his hands. I kind of think it's nice that she doesn't put him on the spot in front of other people. That this encounter that we're going to see, it happens in a way where he's not going to be embarrassed in front of other people. It's just going to be her and him. And I just got to tell you, sometimes you just have to make a move. Some of you may take that wrong, but I'm serious. Sometimes you never know until you try something. I think some of us have this idea that people somehow read our minds. And I can't tell you how many people, this happens all the time. It happens in marriages, too, where people think that the other person reads their mind. I've been talking to people, and they say, well, you know, he did this or he did that, and I don't understand where he came up with this idea, you know. And vice versa, guys saying, she said that she thought that I would be doing this and that. She never told me this. You know what? We have not invented the mind reader machines yet. You have to do something. In relationships, you have to risk sometimes. That's why we don't do it, because we're hoping that, you know, God will magically speak to him or her. No, not necessarily. If he's like me, he's going to be as dead as a doornail. I mean, he's just going to be thick-headed. You know, I needed somebody to slap me upside the head, you know, hit me over the head with a 2x4. Sometimes you have to do something, make a move. But it's hard because you risk the other person saying no. That's why we don't do it, isn't it? Because we don't want to get hurt. But you know what? I tell you what, sometimes it's really worth it. Sometimes it's worth it, I tell you. I think it's worth it. Of course, she was the one that made the moves on me, because I was the thick-headed one. Oh, my gosh. But I was the one that was smart enough to say, I want this girl. I tell you, I figured it out eventually. And oh, man, am I glad that I did. Oh. I think I'm going to owe her $5. What do you think, Earl? Do I? $10? Earl says I owe her $10. Some of you are wondering why that is because we have a rule in our family that I'm not supposed to mention anybody in my family. I didn't really mention her by name, though. But we have a rule in our family that if Daddy says something about somebody during the message, he owes them $5 if he does it without their permission. And I just did that. So I... Twice. Oh, man. Marriage is really good. I tell you, it is. It is. Verse 5. And she said to her, this is Ruth responding, all that you say to me, I will do. All that you say, I will do. There's a lesson here, gang, about wisdom and age. Sometimes, not always, there are always the old fools, but sometimes older people actually know a thing or two. It's surprising for those of us who are younger. That's because I don't qualify anymore for that. But you know, it is true that oftentimes people that are older than you actually know some things. Like this couple. Now, this is a couple. I'm going to show you a clip of a couple who are going to demonstrate the use of a webcam.
No, look at the monkey.
Did it capture? Why did it say? I put it on capture.
That's a pretty good monkey.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wait a minute.
I don't think you.
Oh, here, now do it again.
They don't know what they're doing. I'm so sad. Look at that. All the wrinkles up there and the cracks in my head. I can do Mrs. Dunbar, can I? Oh, it's perfectly all right.
Take a series of photos. I was doing that.
That's okay.
And you can email these to selected media. But why won't I take a picture? Take photo.
Oh, dear. Pardon me.
I did it before by accident.
You're like me. You do more things by accident than most people do on purpose.
Display.
Now, I didn't show you the whole thing. There's a couple more minutes of this, of them recording themselves without realizing what they're doing. And you may be thinking all these seniors don't know what they're doing. But if you watch carefully, these are two people who love each other. In fact, a little bit too much. It gets a little racy. That's why I cut it off. See, the language gets a little bit racy. He loves his wife. And we would do well to ask advice from time to time to people who are a few steps ahead of us. It's not a bad thing. That's one of the threads that's woven into the story of Ruth, is you see Ruth's commitment to paying attention to what Naomi says. There's wisdom in that game. She respects this advice. And so it's verse 6. So it says, so she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. She was taking notes and she went and did this stuff. And after Boaz had eaten and drunk, his heart was cheerful. I mean, it was a great meal. He was a happy camper. And he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. So he goes to lay down. He goes to lay down, and he's worked all hard all day. This is not easy work, and he's tired. He's had a good meal. So he goes, he's out. He's out like a light. And he lays at the end of the heap of grain. He's the guy that owns all this stuff. And so until this stuff gets put away in a safe place, you bet every night he's going to be laying next to the pile of grain, because that's like his income for the next year or two or whatever. And he lays down. Now, she uncovers his feet and lays down. Gang, don't read our 21st century immorality into this. Nothing immoral about this. It's very clean. This is totally G-rated. Don't play stuff in your head that's off. This is simply pure stuff. Nothing impure here at all. She uncovers his feet and she waits for him to wake up. Verse 8. Now it happened at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" So she answered, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative." He says, "Who are you?" Now, we know he's met her. He already knows who she is. Why does he say, "Who are you?" Because there's no lights. There's no candles. We're dark. And so he doesn't know, this looks like a woman to me, but I don't know. Who is this? And she says, "Take your maidservant under your wing." The word for wing, kanaf, can mean wing, extremity, edge, corner, or shirt. It's a word that's used in a couple of ways in the scripture. It's used to describe the wings of the cherubim. Exodus 25:20, "And the cherubim shall stretch out their wings above, covering the mercy seat with their wings." Same language. Stretch out their wings. So it's used of wings. That's kind of probably one reason why New King James translates it that way. It's also used to describe the edge of a garment. Numbers 25:38, "Speak to the children of Israel, tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments." on the corners, like the edges, just like the wings. In Jewish wedding ceremonies, sometimes they will use a prayer shawl called a tallit and either drape it over the couple together, or they'll build a little canopy over it. And it's the same idea as this, stretching it out over them. In fact, this idea is written into most Jewish wedding ceremonies. One commentator writes, to spread a skirt over one is, in the East, a symbolic action denoting protection. To this day, in many parts of the East, to say of anyone that he has put his skirt or is covering over a woman is synonymous with saying that he has married her. And she says, what does she say? She says, take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. The word that's translated close relative, ga'al, you may have heard Bible studies. People use the Hebrew word goel. It's built on this word, ga'al. It means to redeem, to act as a kinsman redeemer. Ruth is reminding Boaz that as a close relative, he has an obligation to redeem, actually, Naomi, the family. For Ruth and Naomi's situation, this is going to involve two things. It's going to involve property. You find this principle in Leviticus chapter 25, where it says, the land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, and you are strangers and sojourners with me. No sale of property in Israel was considered permanent. You never got rid of the family farm. If you got poor and you had to sell something, it would only be until what they call the year of Jubilee, and then everything reverts back to the family. So if you got poor enough, you could sell the land, but it would only be a temporary thing. Verse 24. And then it says, and in all the land of your possession, you shall grant redemption of the land. So every time a sale took place, it was under the condition that it could be bought back by the original family that owned it. Are you with me so far? Verse 25, it says, and if one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and if his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother sold. So if you sell your land to someone outside of the family, a kinsman redeemer, a relative, could come and buy the land back for the family. We think that what's happened is that at some point, Elimelech and Naomi sold the property off, probably when they moved to Moab. And now that Naomi is back, she wants someone to buy it back for the family. And Boaz, that's what Boaz is going to try to do. He's going to try. It's like she sold it to the bank, and now they want to buy it back from the bank. So there's property involved. But this idea of a kinsman redeemer is also, in this story, going to involve the girl. It's not just purchasing the land, but you get an additional added bonus. It's just like those TV offers, you know. But wait, there's more. Not only do you get this 25 acres, but wait, look, there's a nice-looking young gal here attached to this thing. Last week, we looked at what was called the Levirate Law. It's spelled like this. You see it in Deuteronomy 25. We'll look at a few verses again in a minute. But the Levirate Law worked like this. If a husband dies before a baby is born within this marriage, before an heir is born in the marriage, then the brother of the husband had to marry the gal, have kids with her, and those kids would inherit the dead brother's property and name and all like this. Levir is the Latin word for brother-in-law. So the Levirate Law is the brother-in-law law for brother-in-laws. We talked last week about how important it would have been in those days that if your brother gets married, you want to make sure that it's somebody that you would be willing to marry yourself if she dies. You know, otherwise, you want to make sure that your brother goes to the gym every day and takes his cholesterol medicine and stays alive. Okay, let's move on. So these are the things that are going to get wrapped up into one package in Naomi's situation with this redeemer, close relative, Gaal. So she informs him, you are a close relative of ours. Verse 10. Then he said, blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether rich or poor. Now, what kindness did she show at the beginning? Because she hung out and gleaned in his field. Now he's like blown away. Now he finds out she sounds like she's interested in me. Now, if you look at this language in verse 10, you did not go after the young men. See, the kind of implication is that he's not one of the young men. So we think he could be maybe 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years old. I don't know how old he is. But he's not a young man. We think she's probably in her 20s. So there's a bit of an age difference. And he's blown away that she seems to want him. And now, my daughter, do not fear. Do not fear. I will do for you all that you request. For all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. We saw this word last week. Virtuous woman. Kail means strength, efficiency, ability. It's a word that's found in Proverbs 12:4. An excellent wife, same word. An excellent wife is the crown of her husband. But she who causes shame is like rottenness in his bones. Now, here's what I want to bring out. Faithfulness can help the past. He's a dirty, stinking Moabite. And Israelites are kind of supposed to, you know, stay away from dirty, stinking Moabites. But this gal, Ruth, has established a reputation of faithfulness. And this faithfulness has changed her reputation. You know, gang, sometimes we do things that just, that are not, have not, we did kind of hang around our neck for a long time. And we wonder, am I going to have to live with this for the rest of my life? And in a way, yes. But in a way, no. Because you stay faithful. You do the right things. Gain a reputation of faithfulness. And just like Ruth, you know, gosh, Boaz is saying, you know, everybody knows you're a good kid, you're a good girl, you're a good lady. Oh my gosh, you're an excellent, just like, let's see, Ruth is great, great grandmother to Solomon, who says an excellent wife is the crown of her husband. Yeah. Hard work, faithfulness, diligence pays off. And Boaz promises Ruth, I'm going to do my best to do this for you. Verse 12. Now, it is true, he says, it is true that I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. There is a gal that's even more gal, that's got more gal than I do. There's a guy closer than me. And you know what I like about this? This says to me, well, I kind of got the feeling from the last verse that he's kind of interested in the girl. You know, it's like, just like, whoa, you're like, you're interested in me? He's quite flattered by this. But this is a guy that wants to play by the rules. Because the rules are, there's a line of people that are supposed to, you're supposed to approach to redeem. The closest relative goes first. And he knows this. And sometimes the temptation in my life is when I want something really bad, I just kind of like fudge and forget the rules. You know, the girl's interested in me, so what harm could it be? Let's just get married and run off and, you know, live happily ever after. But Boaz himself is a man of integrity. He wants to do it right. He wants to take the time to do it right. Now, I find his response here kind of interesting because even though he knows that she's kind of, he's like, kind of too old for her in one sense. But on the other hand, I kind of get the feeling that he's already thought this through. Don't you? He already knows that there is a relative closer than me. He knows. He knows who the guy is. He's going to meet him. He's going to, you know, connect with the guy. He's going to call the guy on the phone and have him meet for a, you know, a talking to the next day because he wants to make sure he knows who this guy is. So I kind of am thinking, you know, he's probably already been thinking about this. You know, Naomi's back. She's a relative. And there's this, she's brought a girl with her. Oh my gosh, she's a good looking girl. I've heard their story, and wow. Oh, that's right. Fred is closer than me. Oh. Okay, that's just my little interpretation, and there's my little fiction there. We could write a romance novel off of this, couldn't we? Verse 13. He says to her, stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that if he will perform the duty of a close relative for you, good. Let him do it. But if he does not want to perform the duty for you, then I will perform the duty for you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning. So, before Boaz can take the step of being the redeemer, he has to let the other guy have a chance. But he says, if the other guy doesn't want it, then girl, I'm yours. So she lay at his feet until morning, and she rose before one could recognize another. In other words, it's still dark. And he said, do not let it be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. He doesn't want rumors started about whatever went on last night. Then there was no hanky-panky. He just doesn't want the gossip mill going. He might also want to make sure the other guy doesn't know that they've already been talking. You know, I don't know. Verse 15. Also, he said, bring the shawl that is on you and hold it. And when she held it, he measured 6 ephahs of barley and laid it on her. And then she went into the city. Now, the word ephahs is in italics, which means that it's not in the text. It's just the translators threw that in there thinking that there's 6 of something. He threw 6 of something of barley in. Some translations say 6 measures of barley. Some have suggested, and the problem with ephah is that an ephah is about 30 pounds of grain. And so if he did 6 of them, then he's loading her up with 180 pounds of grain. That's a lot. That's a lot for anybody to carry, I tell you. So I don't know that it's 6 ephahs of grain. I don't know. Another suggestion is that it's 6 seahs of grain, which is a third of an ephah, which would mean that he loads her still up with 60 pounds of grain. So that's still kind of hefty, but, you know, carry big kids around on your hips, you know. You can do this kind of thing. So I don't know. Anyway, he loads her up. That's the thing. Verse 16, when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, is that you, my daughter? Then she told her all that the man had done for her. Now, I don't get this. How come? Is that you, my daughter? Must be a bad translation or something. Actually, actually, some translations put it this way. They say, how did it go, my daughter? That's what some of them say. But I got to tell you, the actual Hebrew is this. Is that you, my daughter? So some have suggested, and I like this, that Naomi is saying, are you still Ruth the Moabitess, or are you the prospective Mrs. Boaz? I like that. I just like, so, you know, are you now Mrs. Boaz? Is that what it is? And she said, no, let's see. I have lost my place. Verse 17, and she said, these 6 ephahs he gave me. For he said to me, do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law. Now, the idea is, and it may be that Boaz is reading between the lines and he realizes that Naomi's the one that's fixing this whole thing up. And it may be. And if so, he's sending a message back to Naomi through Ruth saying, I am definitely interested. You know, that's the meaning for the big weight, a bunch of stuff. And then she said, sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out, for the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day. She tells her, sit still. Just sit still, girl. Naomi is convinced that Boaz is going to do something. And that's the hard thing, isn't it? To sit still. To have patience. There is a time for action, like when she follows Naomi's advice and goes and lays next to Boaz's feet. But there's also a time to be patient and to wait. A man rushed into the doctor's office and he started shouting, doctor, doctor, I'm shrinking, I'm shrinking, I think I'm shrinking. And the doctor calmly responded, now settle down. You'll just have to be a little patient. I like that one. I really like that one. A little patient. Just calm down. Just be a little. Okay. I know you all got it. I just had to try to milk it for as many chuckles as I could. And actually, we don't need to be a little patient. We need to be very patient. We need to be very patient. We need to learn to let go of things and let God take care of them. Psalm 37, for some of you, this is probably one of your favorite psalms. Delight yourself also in the Lord, and He shall give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in Him, and He shall bring it to pass. He shall bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for Him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the wicked man who brings wicked schemes to pass. Wait on the Lord. Rest in Him. Wait patiently for Him. Chapter 4. Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Come aside, friend, sit down here." So he came aside and sat down. He goes to the gate, and we've talked about this many times. In ancient times, the gate was the place in the city. It was where you fought off the enemies. It was where they would set up the town market, would be at the gate of the city. It is also the place, we would call it the seat of government. It's where the old guys hung out, not just to play chess, but to help run things, would be at the gate of the city. The elders, the leaders, would hang out at the gate of the city. People would conduct business. Judgment would be made at the gates of the city. And as he sits, as he goes to the gate, he sees the close relative comes by. This is the guy that we've been talking about, the other guy that's closer. He would be Boaz's relative as well. He's related to Boaz. And he says, "Come aside, friend, sit down here." Now, I found this fascinating. In the Old King James, it says, he puts it this way, "Ho, such a one." Now, it sounds more friendly, the New King James. "Come aside, friend." But actually, the Old King James in this place is a better translation. I'll tell you in a minute. "Ho, such a one." Because this phrase in the Hebrew, in rabbinic writings, this is that phrase, "such a one," is equivalent to our modern John Doe. He doesn't call the fellow by name. The passage just calls him "such a one." It just calls him John Doe. That doesn't sound like a very close friend. But I think there's a reason why we don't know his name. His name is kept from us on purpose. He lost his chance. He will lose his chance forever for being known as a redeemer in Israel. He lost his chance. He didn't take his chance. No risk, no name. No risk, no name. Sometimes you got to risk a little bit. Sometimes you have to step outside of your comfort zone. You're going to see this guy doesn't quite want to step outside of his comfort zone. He wants to risk a little bit, but not too much. Here's a great quote. "It is not the critic who counts, not the person who points out where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the person who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes up short again and again, who knows the great enthusiasms, the devotions, and spends himself or herself in worthy cause, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and at the worst, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his or her place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat." Theodore Roosevelt. You know, we don't want to fail, and that's one reason why we don't try. Nobody likes to fail. But if you don't try, you're not going to accomplish much. I find that fascinating about this fellow. The relative with no name. His name is kept from us. He should be in the story. We know Elimelech. We know the sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and Ruth and Naomi and Orpah. Sounds like a Orpah, like a whale or something. Yeah, sorry. But we don't know this fellow's name. We should, because he's like right in the middle of it. He's closer than Boaz, but we don't know his name because he didn't want to risk it. And says, and he took, this is probably Boaz, took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. Let's call court let's call everybody to work here. 10 men of the elders. Now, normally, 2 or 3 witnesses were enough to witness an agreement, but it is usual to gather 10 elders if the matter is really, really important, such as with a marriage, a divorce, or a purchase of property. So they call 10 men, 10 elders of the city together. Then he said to the close relative, the no-name guy, Boaz says, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold a piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am the next after you. And he said, no name says, oh yeah, I'll redeem it. So he brings up this property thing, and he says, there's a piece of property there, you know, are you gonna take care of this? And the guy goes, oh, okay, sure, I'll do it, I'll buy it. Then Boaz says, but wait, there's more. On the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. On the day you buy the field, you got to pick up the girl as well. She comes with it. This is proper. Not only is there this right of property redemption, but there's the leveret thing going on as well. Treasure in the field. The relative wants the field, but not the girl. I kind of don't think Boaz needs or wants the field, but he wants the girl. Do you think that's probably accurate? I think I could probably see that in here. The relative wants the field, but not the girl. Boaz wants the field, doesn't want the field, he wants the girl. And he's willing to buy the field in order to get the girl. That reminds me of this parable where Jesus said, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and hid. And for joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Jesus thinks you are a treasure. And he purchased the entire planet. He paid enough for the entire planet so that he could get you. There's treasure in the field. And that's what Jesus thinks of you. He thinks you're his treasure. You are his treasure. And the close relative said, drum roll please, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. You redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. He says, I'm not sure I can do this. Now, some people are nice and they're saying, well, you know, he's probably already married. He's got kids of his own. And if he takes Ruth and has children by her, then he's got to split up his own inheritance with not only his own kids, but now with these other kids. And some people say, but that way, I think it could be that maybe his wife doesn't like the idea of him having a young gal come into the thing, family home, you know. Oh, I could see that. And perhaps the man didn't think he wanted to have to take 2 poor widows to have to take care of. I don't know, because he, you know, there is another hidden one there in the thing as well. And Naomi kind of comes along because she's a part of the deal. Maybe he didn't want to be associated with a Moabitess. Maybe he's afraid that if he marries the Moabitess, he's going to die like her last husband. Who knows? But he decides, you know, I don't think I want to do this. Verse 7. Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm anything, one man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was a confirmation in Israel. Therefore, the close relative said, buy it for yourself. So he took off his sandal. Now, when it says he took off his sandal, I kind of get the feeling that by Ruth's day and age, this has become some kind of a goofy custom. Like, what is the world buddy take off the sandal for? What's that have got to do anything? But actually, this is a part of the Levirate law. In Deuteronomy 25, it says, the elders of the town will then summon him and talk with him. If he still refuses and says, I don't want to marry her, the widow must walk over to him in the presence of the elders, pull his sandal from his foot, and spit in his face. Then she must declare, this is what happens to a man who refuses to provide his brother with children. Ever afterward in Israel, his family will be referred to as the family of the man whose sandal was pulled off. And it's got a big loogie just dripping down his face. Oh, my God. We think the idea of removing the sandal, one suggestion is that it's like making you the equivalent of a slave, a shoeless slave. You take the sandal off the guy's foot. It would be humiliation. It would make him a no-name guy, which he is. He's a no-name guy. This man has refused to raise up offspring for his dead brother. Verse 9. And Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from his position at the gate. You are witnesses this day. Now, look, one quick thing. It mentions that she's the widow of Mahlon. So now we actually know which of the two sons she was married to. She was not married to Chilion, whose name meant pining. She wasn't meant to the whining kid. She was married to the sickly kid. So just in case you were curious about that. And it says, I have redeemed. I'm going to talk for a little bit about this concept of redemption. Here's one definition of redemption. To set free from bondage by paying a price. That's one concept of this idea of redeeming. To set free from bondage by paying a price. Now, there is a prerequisite to redemption, and that's bondage. Somebody has to be in bondage for them to be redeemed. That's kind of part of the, it's kind of understood. Ruth and Naomi were in bondage with their debts. We are under a different kind of bondage. Jesus said in John 8:34, most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. We have been under bondage to sin. And so we need a redeemer. Now, there are qualifications for a redeemer. I think I can see three of them here. Three qualifications for a redeemer. First, he has to be, to qualify for a redeemer, he has to be a near kinsman. It's got to be a blood relative. That was the whole idea, the kinsman redeemer, a ga'al. He has to be a near kinsman. That's why Jesus took on human flesh, to qualify himself as our kinsman redeemer. Hebrews chapter 2 says, inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, that's you and me, we got flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil. He redeemed us through his death. And since he's got the same stuff as us, he's a relative of us, then with his death, that's how he redeems us, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. This is why Jesus took on human flesh. At John chapter 1, the Word became flesh and and dwelt among us. He did this to qualify as a near kinsman. There's a second qualification. He's got to be willing, not like the no-name fellow. The kinsman redeemer has to be willing. He has to be willing to pay for the ones that are in bondage. Is there enough money in the account? No. That's the next question. Is Jesus willing to? Well, yes, he does. He wants to. Hebrews 12:2. Therefore, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. That's why he took on human flesh. John the Baptist said at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, behold the Lamb of God, who's going to, I'm drawing a blank here. What does it say in John chapter 1? Who takes away the sins of the world. This is why he came. He came to die for us, to break the bondage, to redeem us. Third thing, he has to be near kinsman, he has to be willing, he has to be able. In other words, he's got to actually have something in the bank to pay for it. So, you know, your relative says, I'm dying, I'm in the debt, I can't, I need help, I need a redeemer. You say, I'll be a redeemer. And then you realize, wait, my bank account's broke too. Well, you can't be a redeemer if you can't pay for it. He has to be able. Jesus paid with the greatest price of all. 1 Peter 1. Knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver and gold from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. I think that when we get to heaven, we will realize that he has paid with the most precious, valuable substance that there is in the universe. It's not gold or whatever the latest precious metal is. The most important, precious, valuable thing in the universe is the blood of Christ, the blood of God who gave himself, his life that he gave for us. And that's what he paid for you. That kind of says something about how much he thinks you're worth. Doesn't it? Kind of thinks you're worth something. I don't think you're worth anything. Well, actually, I know for me, I know I'm not worth anything. That's the way I feel. I don't know if you feel that way. I feel that way a lot. I do. But the truth is, beloved, your value is determined by what someone's willing to pay for you. He paid with his life. Eternal life. That's how much you're worth. A redeemer has to be a near kinsman. He has to be willing. He has to be able. So how can I be redeemed if I think I need to be redeemed? You get it right here from the book of Ruth. Remember, he said, and who are you? And she said, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. You ask. That's how you get redeemed. You ask. Ruth asked Boaz to be her redeemer. You ask Jesus to be yours. He is near. He is willing. And he is able. One last note about redemption. We'll talk about final redemption. We've already seen this in the book of Revelation, have we? Has any of this sounded familiar to the stuff? We've kind of already hinted back at the book of Ruth when we went through Revelation, especially chapter 5. The tribulation is the process of redemption. And just as redemption took place at the gates of the city, redemption for the planet takes place at the throne of heaven. And there aren't just 10 elders. Remember we talked about how normally it's two or three elders you pull together or something. If it's really, really important, you pull 10. Well, God's got 24 elders at this transaction. And there is a redeemer who is worthy, who is able. He's a near kinsman. He wants to redeem us, and he's able. The cry in heaven was, who is worthy to open the scroll. Just almost kind of like Boaz saying, you know, who's the close relative? Jesus is the one. And so we're kind of watching this whole process that's initiated in the Old Testament. We're watching it in the book of Revelation being fleshed out in the end. Verse 11, and all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. The Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Israel. And may you prosper in Ephratah and be famous in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman. Now it mentions Rachel and Leah. And this is apparently part of the typical Jewish wedding blessing. May your wife be like Rachel and Leah. Who in the world are Rachel and Leah? Well, they're two of Jacob or Israel's wives. He actually ends up with four wives before he's done. But the thing is that the whole nation is populated, in a sense, from these gals. They're the mother of a nation, the mothers of the nation. And it says, may you prosper in Ephratah. We've talked about this before. Ephratah means fruitful. It is another name for Bethlehem. Simply another name for Bethlehem. And she says, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. The people of Bethlehem are not only descendants of Israel, but they're descendants of Judah, one of the tribes of Israel. And Perez is one of the sons, just read Genesis 38. We just finished reading that in our quiet time. It was today even. Strange, bizarre story. It's the whole beginning of the Levirate Law, by the way. Because Judah has three sons, Onan and Shelah. And I don't remember Shelah's name because he's the one that really doesn't play much of a role. Was a bad dude, and God killed him because he's married, and he's a bad guy, and he's married to a gal named Tamar, and he dies. Well, then Onan is supposed to step up to the plate, and he doesn't exactly do that. And God says, I'm frustrated with you, and God kills him. So Tamar is left without a husband to raise up seed for the son, and by that time, Judah is getting a little skittish about giving his youngest son to this girl. She's already killed off two of his boys. Wondering, what does she put in that stew? I mean, she calls it a killer stew, but it's really a killer stew. What do we do? And so he's a little reluctant to give his youngest boy, he hasn't even finished college yet, what do I do, And so he says, girl, just go home to your daddy's house and we'll get you connected with the last son in a while. Well, he never comes and gets around to it. And this girl is actually an honorable girl, even though you wouldn't believe it by what she's about to do. She dresses up as a prostitute. Because she finds out that Judah is not going to follow through on this promise. And she dresses up as a prostitute to entice Judah. And he doesn't recognize her. And he ends up getting her pregnant. And then word gets out that she's pregnant. And he's so upset and frustrated, he says, let's go burn this woman. She's such an immoral woman. What a terrible woman. And then she says, oh, by the way, it's the guy that owns all this stuff, which he had given her a couple months back. And he says, it's the guy that owns this stuff. Do you happen to recognize who this could belong to? And he realizes that she kept the Levirate Law, even though he wouldn't. It goes back to the same principles that are going through the book of Ruth. And she ends up having twins. I was thinking about this the other day. He loses two sons, Er and Onan. They die because of wickedness. Because of Tamar, she gives birth to two sons. I thought that's kind of interesting. Perez and Zerah. And so all these people are around because of somebody following the Levirate Law. And people, it's just an interesting thing. Anyway, so verse 13. Oh, Judah's story. Okay. Verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And she then, and when he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a close relative. May his name be famous in Israel." I like this. The women say this to Naomi. Concept, women blessing women. I like the example here. Women in the book of Ruth, I don't know if you've noticed this, women are the key to the whole book of Ruth. They're not unimportant in God's plans. You can't do the book of Ruth without the women. That's kind of like obvious, isn't it? And here it's the women that bless Naomi. Remember when she first came into town, she was saying, "Oh, don't call me Naomi," which means pleasant me. "I decided to change my name to Mara," which means bitterness, because God's been really bad to me. He's bitter. I'm just a bitter old woman. And here are these women at the end of the story blessing her. I like that concept. I like the concept of women blessing women. They're reminding her that God has not forgotten her. Verse 15, "And may he, this child, be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you is better to you than seven sons has borne him." May this boy be a restorer to life. This is what God's all about, gang, is restoring people. And I'm running out of time, so let me just say this. Think about the life of Joseph. 17 years old, and his brothers sell him off as a slave into Egypt. Life is rotten for 13 years for Joseph. Totally rotten. But God changes things. God turns things around. He saves the world. Sounds like a movie or something. He saves the world. And when he has his kids, it says, this is in Genesis 41, when you get to the name of his kids, he calls them Ephraim and Manasseh. And the names are significant because Manasseh means forgetful or forget. He says, "God has made me forget all my trouble, all my toil and trouble in my father's house." Ephraim means fruitful. He says, "Now God has made me fruitful." See how God turns things around? He can do that. Be patient. Let him work. And they say to her, "Better to you than seven sons is this woman." Don't miss the treasures around you. Don't miss the treasures. She shows up at the train station in Bethlehem with, "Oh, how horrible life is. God is terrible. Oh, he's forgotten me." And she's got the treasure right there. She's got Ruth with her. She doesn't even have to look for any. She doesn't even have to find the treasure. The treasure's with her the whole time. The treasure is the one that says, "I'm going to go wherever you go. I'm going to stay wherever you stay. Your people will be my people. Your God's." And she's right there the whole time. Isn't that interesting? And sometimes we think, "Oh, woe is me. I wish life were better," you know. Sometimes the treasure's right there. Don't miss the treasure, gang. Naomi took the child, laid him on her bosom, and became a nurse to him. That's fascinating. I won't go there. Okay. And the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, "There is a son born to Naomi," and they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Obed, his name means serving or servant. Verse 18, now this is the genealogy of Perez. We talked about Perez. Perez begot Hezron. Hezron begot Ram. Ram begot Amminadab. And Amminadab begot Nahshon. Nahshon, Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz. Boaz begot Obed. Obed begot Jesse. And Jesse begot David. That's the whole point of the story, is to give us a peek at the lineage of King David. That's one of the points of the story. There's a lot of points in the story. But to get us to this point, let's stand and pray.